Hi, I'm Roger Maloney.
And I'm Monty Burnett Maloney.
And welcome to After the Kids Go to Bed. Monty, what's this show about?
Our show is about following our journey through marriage, children, work, and our life balance while as a family in New York City.
Just like the city that never sleeps, life for us starts after the kids go to bed. I hope you guys enjoy it. This is Roger Maloney, one half of After the Kids Go to Bed. Please enjoy this next episode where Monty interviews her good friend, Christina Jones. Christina is the founder of Brothers Empowered to Teach. We're talking education, and some more education. Education has changed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And tune into this episode so that you can be fully informed on how to navigate through these crazy times. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Christina Jones.
What's happening?
Is that you?
How are you?
I am good.
It is me.
I am good.
It is me.
This is perfect. Okay, you sound good. So the hood works have begun in our neighborhood. They have started a little late tonight, so there's nothing we could do. Hence why we record this stupid show in the middle of the night.
I see. Well, you know, it's Juneteenth weekend and happy and Father's
yes,
Day.
Yes. A lot to celebrate. So we got, you may hear the booming in the background, but it's going to be okay. We did a little testing, so you barely hear it on the recording, but if it gets bad, we'll try to edit that out. So, I'll do a little introduction because I can edit all of this out. So I'll do a little introduction and then we'll get started.
Okay.
So hello, everybody, and welcome to our next episode of After the Kids Go to Bed. This is Monty.
This is Roger Maloney.
And we're here to talk about education and something that we are deeply concerned about and excited for all the new changes to occur. We have survived, for lack of a better term, remote learning with our children, and we are looking forward to figuring out what the next steps are going to look like when school reopens and, you know, what education is going to look like after this pandemic. So we requested and asked a good friend of ours, Ms. Christina Jones, who is in education. In education empowerment, I'll say. I'll let her tell you better what she does. But when I thought of who to speak to regarding education, she was the first person I thought of. So I'm happy to have Christina on, who is the co-founder of Brothers Empowered to Teach, an organization based in New Orleans. And I'm going to stop talking and let her talk and tell you about the wonderful work she does. So, Christina, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast. I've been checking out your episodes, and I love what you guys have going on.
Thank you. Thank you. This love, this labor of love. You know how it is, because you have your own. It truly is a labor of love trying to get these accomplished. So, please tell us about Brothers Empowered to Teach and how you and your co-founder, Larry, came up with the idea and what where you are in the present tense of your organization.
Sure. So my co-founder, Larry, and I met each other in Mardi Gras 2011. It can't be more of a New Orleans story than at the balcony of the Blue Nile. And we got to know each other and became fast friends. And he told me that I was a carpetbagger because it was right after Katrina. And so there are a lot of folks from up north, up our way, who wanted to come to New Orleans and put their proverbial hand in the pile, but were unwilling to understand the culture and make up how New Orleans functioned before the storm, and you know what ailed it after the storm. But long story short, my good friend Amber Seeley, who I went to graduate school with, a new school, had met Larry and talked to him about his story of growing up in New Orleans. And like a lot of young Black men who grew up in urban places, He had 1 foot in the street and 1 foot in academics. And he was a coach and a former teacher, and she came across the Echoing Green Fellowship and suggested to him that he apply for it. So Larry and I started talking about it, and he had what we thought was a corny idea at first, which is about a writing club for middle schoolers. And we started talking about teachers in our lives and his mom and my grandfather. And I suggested to him that we consider ways to get more Black men to teach. And, you know, as a teacher and coach, Larry said, you know, teaching has become a last resort for a lot of college students. Black men don't see themselves in classrooms very often, and when and have had their own negative experiences in school, and teaching pays terribly, you know. And he's like, Black men, you know, have families they need to take care of and things they need to accomplish, and you know, there doesn't seem like the current public education space makes room for Black men.
That is true.
And so it took a little convincing. We talked about it a little more, and he said, well, if we're going to do teaching, then we need to figure out how, sorry, my neighbor rang my doorbell. it's a neighborly
city.
I'm sure.
That's very Southern. That's deep South.
So we started talking about it, and we said, well, you know, if we're going to do teaching, then we have to change the story about what teaching looks like. And we have to figure out a way to connect Black men to the career of teaching. Mm-hmm. And so we came up on this idea to start with young men when they're in college, when they haven't yet figured out what they're going to do. We both talked about how we spent a lot of time in college. You know, Larry went to LSU, got a football scholarship, went to San Jose State, like a lot of people got. A lot of young men didn't work out, was listening to his friends back home about what he should be doing and shouldn't mm-hmm. be doing. Transferred to junior college. All these things that happen to a lot of young men when they go to college, they're not really quite sure whether they're. And so we decided to start with them when they're in college. And so long story short, Brothers in Power to Teach's mission is to inspire and incentivize young men, particularly Black men, to consider education as a career. And we do that by starting with them when they're sophomores in college. Giving them a small stipend and some personal and professional development over a 3-year period, showing them what it looks like for them to be in classrooms, what it looks like for them to lead in classrooms, and hopefully build a disposition within them to choose to be educators. And so we've been doing that since 2012. That was when we first came up with the idea. And in 2014, it became a real true thing. And so we're now entering year 6 of having a real legitimate business. We have expanded from 7 fellows in New Orleans to over 50 fellows in the South Louisiana region, which includes Baton Rouge. We're hoping in the next few years to expand to another 5 cities, including Jackson and Memphis and Detroit. We really see the Middle South as some place that is often neglected, but there are a lot of young Black men who go to local Black colleges and other schools who tend to come home. And so we want to, you know, grow your own where you are. Because we know that when people are connected to the community and they're connected to kids, then we're going to have better results.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know we've talked about this. So Christina and I, whenever she comes up, we sit, we have lunch and or brunch, and it turns into like a good 5-hour
summit
convo. Just to give a little history about me and Christina, we both went to NYU together, and she graduated. I did not. I'm a happy dropout. she's had an illustrious career. And I think what I love about seeing your progress is you were also in community planning, right? And city planning.
Yep. I was a community development banker for a number of years. That's how I got to New Orleans, actually.
And so you can see the world from two different aspects, right? The way I see it is like you can be in the community and see what's going on in the ground, but then kind of take from a 10,000 level view, 10,000 foot view, what the possibilities are. And if you could talk a little bit more about that, like your journey to New Orleans before you started that work.
Sure. So when I was at the new school, the day I was leaving DC, Katrina happened. And I was on my way to New York, or on my way back to New York, because my friend Brady's mother would say that I dodged death twice in 2001, because I would have been walking through the trade, and I was not, because I had just decided to move to D.C. And I would have been out by the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11 for the contract job I had moved to D.C. for, which was really me chasing a boy.
Wow.
And I wasn't there either. So fast forward 4 years later, I'm ready to leave DC, and I'm getting ready to get out of my car and go back to New York for graduate school, and Katrina happens on national TV, and I sat on that couch, and I think I cried for that whole day.
We all did.
And I did not go to New York that day. Yeah. And my good friend Casey was my roommate in DC. Our friend Mary Parker was living in New Orleans, going to Tulane. And I remember me and Casey trying to figure out how we were going to get in the car and go get married. And of course, our roommate Maurice was like, y'all can't go there. Y'all, I know y'all want to go. Y'all can't go. So we just going to have to wait for Mary to call. But long story short, when I got to graduate school in New York, Katrina was on my mind. And I'd always had a thing for New Orleans in my heart. And I'd learned that my grandparents got married like a block, two blocks away from where I lived in New Orleans.
Eventually, how full circle. Right? That's so, really full circle.
Right. And so I knew I wanted to come to New Orleans at some point. And that same friend, Amber, who recommended the fellowship, she got wind of a fellowship that I told her about at University of Pennsylvania that had been suspended, but they redid the fellowship to respond to Katrina and send folks who were interested or mid-career in community development to New Orleans. And she applied and told me after the fact that she got it. So, you know, she came to New Orleans and, you know, she's still my really, really good friend. And we just kept talking about, well, how do I get to New Orleans? And so I stayed in New York for a while, and then she called me one day and she said, so there's a job in New Orleans running the Louisiana Loan Fund for LISC, which is a who's headquartered in New York, the Local Initiative Support Corporation. They're a big community development intermediary, which basically means people give them money to lend and invest in community development projects. Okay. So the Thurgood Marshall Academy in Harlem would be one. There are a bunch of projects on 125th where the Bally's and all that shopping plaza
yes.
could be. Lyft would be in, invest in that those kind of
oh,
projects,
wow. okay.
right? And so like a lot of folks, they poured a bunch of resources into the Gulf Coast, and the Pew Foundation asked LISC to come back to New Orleans, even though it had closed its office before Katrina and run this loan fund. But LISC had run into problems. They hadn't had a person in the position for like 9 months. They hadn't met their goals, and their contract was coming up for expiration. So it was kind of like, you take this job, it may not last, and you got a whole lot of work to do.
Talk about stepping out on faith. You were really stepping out on faith.
Yeah, and I left behind my longtime boyfriend, my beautiful apartment in Brooklyn, and moved to New Orleans part-time. So I lived in Brooklyn half the time. I lived in New Orleans half the time for a whole year. But I moved here, and, you know, I think my background at going to the new school, you know, NYU was what it was.
Yes.
You know, we were both there. You know. It costs a lot of money. I'm sure that there's some benefit I've gotten from being affiliated with the university, but it wasn't a good time. Right. And the new school was the exact opposite.
Yes.
Which is funny because I really wanted to go to the new school as an undergrad, but nobody had heard of the new school. So I went to NYU.
No, like I always talk about that because a lot of people were like, you know, someone else recently I had been introduced to went to the new school. And I'm like, I remember when no one knew what that school was. And now, like, between Parsons and, I mean, it was Eugene Lang, right? Wasn't it called that before? It was called the new school. And it was like this.
It was called the school in exile. Yeah. First.
It was this little rinky dinky school that was really sort of brewing in the same area as NYU. And I think people used to, like, kind of mistake they can't, but be like, nah, that ain't it. And so,
right. So, I mean, you know, the new school was started as a school in exile because after World War II, right? And so it's known for its jazz program. It's a phenomenal jazz program. So that It was a niche school.
Like
right?
up the street from NYU, completely.
Like across the street, and sometimes. But the new school changed my whole perspective about all kinds of things. You know, like it really produces some socially minded entrepreneurial academics, right? And so, when I moved here, because I had done the community development project, the Chase competition at New School, and I had taken all these policy classes, et cetera. So I kind of already had an idea of, like, when you come here, like, you cannot come to New Orleans and say, this is how we do it in New York. This is how they do it in DC, mm-hmm. right? Because New Orleans is like New York in the fact that no other place is right. like it, right? So it has its own unique challenges, it has its own unique needs. And while there may be some things that are common to all urban places, just the rich, unique Africanness of New Orleans requires you to have a different right. approach. And so I moved here and was able to successfully get the loan fund up and running and convince some people to borrow. It took a while, but I also got people's respect and I think it has carried over into the work I do now, because I still do community development work. Like, I'm a commissioner for the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority. I'm vice chair of a community development corporation that just started here. So I still, you know, keep my feet on right. the ground, which I think is really helpful in sort of the ed space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you get to New Orleans as like a rebuilder, right? You're coming in mm-hmm. to rebuild. And I think it's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you too, because I feel like every place else, mostly New York right now, is like post-Katrina, right? Mm-hmm. We have, you know, infrastructures that have completely broken down and, mm-hmm. you know, 1.1 million students who literally had to walk away from school at the beginning of March mm-hmm. and learn a new way. And there's going to be a lot of changes that are going to happen. I mean, everyone's like itching to get back to normal, but there, you know, we have to really accept a new normal. And, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think we even understand what that means right now, but you've seen it occur. So I want you to kind of talk about some of that, like, you know, especially when it comes to education and like what you're doing to me is like rebuilding, like of all the things we read about education in New Orleans is not great, particularly with the school system. The charter school system and how, you know, some things are good, some things are bad. Some things are in the middle, but they're still trying to figure out. And New Orleans is all I see the stuff I've read, kind of the great experiment, which is probably going to happen here as well. So, you know, in you developing this organization to get people, to get particularly Black men into education, how do you see, like, I mean, COVID is happening everywhere. However, we were more established we had an established school system that now has to rethink. Whereas you guys, Katrina had to literally rebuild everything. And then charter schools came in and now you're having to sort of reset again with the different structures. So how do you see, you know, your organization really plowing through into this new normal? And talk about like,
First, I'm going to talk about from my own personal perspective, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, for you, the audience is listening, New Orleans is 100% charter school.
Okay.
We do not have a traditional public school system. Each charter is considered, each charter management organization, or ELA, which is a federal government term for learning district, is its own district, essentially.
Wow. Okay.
Right? And while autonomy is good, autonomy in a full charter system is a complete challenge, yes. right? Because everyone's going to have a different response of how they want to do things or return, mm-hmm. right? And so I would say that COVID has forced our school board to do what it is tasked to do, which is manage the school system, right? I think because we got to charters and we got to autonomy, there's a lot of like, well, you know, that's the charter's business, that's the charter's business, that's the charter's business. But that has caused nothing but consternation for a lot of parents. Sure. Right? So, you know, pre-Katrina, someone would say that there were 16 to 17 schools that were like, quote unquote, A, right? I don't necessarily believe in letter grades, but quote unquote, mm-hmm. A schools, right? People would say post-Katrina charter school management, we have 16 to 18 schools that are A's. And some of those same schools were schools that existed before Katrina, and those schools are magnets.
Oh, interesting. Right? Okay.
I think that what's going to happen, and it's going to happen not only here, but in other urban places, is that we're really going to have a conversation about equity.
Yes.
Right? You sent home 1.1 million students in New York City to learn at a distance. What percentage of those students had access to internet? Right. Reliable technology, right? So in New Orleans, the school shut down on March 13th. 40% of those students did not have technology that was readily available to them for the first 2 weeks.
I would probably say about the same here. I don't think people would admit it, but I would guarantee, I would swear on it.
Right. And so then we scramble to figure out how to get everybody technology, mm-hmm. right? Because the school system doesn't manage schools directly, you can only go by what you say in your charter. So if school said they managed people's technology one for one, and we know that every student didn't have technology, which I know for a fact, and you know, I sit on a charter board here, which is a discussion for another mm-hmm. day, but then they're not doing that, right? Right. Then we're scrambling to figure out how to get that technology to them. And then we're scrambling to figure out how to help those families know how to use that technology.
right?
And while we're sending home homework packets like summertime and you can come pick them up, et cetera, we still have another problem because the charter schools mean that nobody's going to a neighborhood school.
Mm.
Right? And we don't live in New York City. We live in New Orleans. There's 380,000 people who live here. It's likely that you know your mama, know their mama mm-hmm. and them, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's like, or somebody's people, you know somebody who knows them, right? And because of how the city's made, like a good approximation would be like, I live in Harlem. My child goes to school in Astoria, Queens.
Oh, wow. Right? Okay.
I don't have a car, but there's a school meeting that I'm supposed to be at. And we don't have a subway or a system like that, right? The buses here run every 30 minutes during rush hour. But other than that, they run every hour, right? So can you imagine being a mom who lives on one side of town, has to go to the other side of town, and now COVID happens. The buses are not mm-hmm. running like they were running before because we're on quarantine. So now you can't even really go over there and get the homework packet because you have to find someone to get it mm-hmm. to, right? So let's add the additional pressure that we've already putting on teachers to do these tests, right? To now figure out how they're going to get your child a homework packet because the stakes have been raised so much higher. And while we're all sitting around going, yay, 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 about how hard we work these teachers, we were working them really hard before mm-hmm. the thing. And I can tell you now that teachers are going to leave these classrooms.
I keep saying that. I'm like, God bless them. God bless them.
And unless we're really willing to have a full conversation about education, like we are putting teachers in a box. We're not allowing them to be creative. We're saying that we have differentiated learning for the students that are in our class, but they cannot pivot or change on a dime to try to figure out how to motivate their students. You know, like some of these schools literally have scripts that first year teachers are supposed to follow. Right. So what happens if something happens off script?
Right.
Then what? You go find the principal and figure out what the next line is. Right? Like, this is where we are in education. We're trying to turn education into widgets. Children aren't widgets. Teachers aren't widgets. And unless we recognize that teaching and education is a people business and it requires us to respond to people's humanity, then we're going to be in trouble.
Serious trouble.
So that's where I think we are. Now, in terms of New York, I think we have to rethink education. I think that I was listening to Reverend Otis Moss mm-hmm. III, who preaches at Trinity Community Church in Church of Christ in Chicago. You know, I'm a card carrying Christian and a firm believer in liberation theory theology. Yes. And he was talking today about what we need to do for the babies, and particularly in education. And one of the things he talked about was like, you know, we have learned, the blessing that we have learned during this time is that, like, parents have figured out their children can self-direct.
Yes.
With education. Parents have figured out a schedule that works better for the yes. family, right? You know what I mean? So, like, in New Orleans, you literally could have an 8-year-old standing at the bus stop at 5:45 in the morning, semi in the dark, waiting mm-hmm. for the bus, mm-hmm. right? So families have figured out, they figured out the things that motivate their children. They figured out things they like and want to learn about, and they figured out how to integrate that into their day, right? They've also figured out how to let kids be kids. Go ride your bike, go outside, go, you know what I mean? Go play with the neighbors. I have not seen so many children in the street playing in the longest time.
Very
right?
true. Yes.
And it makes me excited. And when a kid is about to get himself in trouble, I can see, baby, get yourself out of the street. Yes, ma'am. Right? Thank you. That's mm-hmm. it. The village. Mm-hmm. You can't be the village if everybody's in the house and you got parents afraid to say, I need help. Right? I don't know what to do. Right? We can't have kids being well educated and feeling like they own their education if teachers can't make decisions about what some things that they want to include in the curriculum. You can't improve education when I hear high school students say that there's so much structure that they check out and they drop
yes.
out.
You yes, know what I mean? I hear you.
And then we say, well, I don't understand why all these kids are dropping out, because they're not seen in classrooms. Right?
Absolutely.
They're treated like they're in the ward.
The ward, exactly. Feels like prison,
you know?
It feels like prison.
Right.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because I literally had a conversation with a friend last night about, you know, asking her how her son fared for the school year. And we both were saying how our children literally thrived the last 4 months. Whereas, like, mm-hmm. last year, Sienna struggled. Seventh grade was rough. She grew, like, 4 inches.
Seventh grade is terrible.
She became like the 50-foot woman. Her brain was on fire, you know, trying to get to school on time. They changed their arrival time and to a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. and trying to get her up. Like, we literally fought against her natural growth progression. And so I was mm-hmm. really worried about her, because, you know, seventh grade is where they judge all the kids for high school. So mm-hmm. we got through seventh grade and we were like by the skin of our teeth, she did okay. So we went into every year at the beginning of school year, we set goals for them, and they set like a grade goal and reading goal. And if we hit a marker on one, and the others are kind of, you know, leveling out, we're okay. If they're reading enough books, if they're hitting their grade goals, if they're struggling, we try to reassess. So I've worked this process out with my kids. But being home with them for the last 4 months, you know, realizing that, you know, getting them up at 7 a.m, while it's all good for all of us to do and get out the house and be on time, they were zombies. You know, they worked better getting up at 10 and preparing, making themselves breakfast, starting school at 11, which Sienna School started classes at 11:55 because it worked better for the teachers, particularly the ones who were parents who had to deal with their own children. And they did like basically 12 to 3 every day. Lectures, Google Classroom, they were set up. Devin mm-hmm. Rose School did similar. They had a little hard way to go. They, like you said, they weren't ready for the change because they were so kind of locked in to what their program was that they couldn't pivot mm-hmm. as quickly. And the toddler, we had to work him out. We'll talk about him afterwards. But they both actually accelerated in their grades. They went from mid-80s to 90s, some 100s. They could actually explain to me what their work was, because they were actually getting the 15 hours of sleep that they needed for growing. Mm-hmm. And we were also home together, they didn't feel like they had to fight me for time. which was something we always struggled with because I work a lot. You know, my husband, he was mostly home, but he works as well. So we always clamored for those evening hours to have time in the weekends, and you're just competing, right? So our family dynamic completely changed because of COVID in a much better way, which I'm like struggling a little bit. Like, you know, I'm not ready to go back to the office. I do like us all being together. They actually got to go to their grandmother's and spend time with her and be away from us. And I just noticed, like, I had this epiphany that, you know, when it's time for them to leave to go to college, regardless of what may meet them there when it happens, I think they'll be more prepared because of this experience. And so my girlfriend was saying the same thing. She was like, at one point, her son was asking her to make lunch because he had back-to-back Zooms. And he was like, you know, I'm in the middle of meetings. Can you help me out? And she had to stop herself and like, who's this man I'm talking to? And he's in the third or fourth grade. I believe he's in the fourth grade. And she said she was able to not ride him so hard because he was able to kind of get a hold of his own schedule and manage. And the same thing with my girls. And I imagine other parents have the same experience. I've heard some bad experience as well, but I feel like, you know, it's a responsibility of parents to say, hey, I, like you said, I got to see what works and what we were doing wasn't working.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that schools are going to have to rethink the way they operate, right? I think they're going to have to rethink the way that they engage parents. I think parents are going to have to force schools. We're going to have to collectively as a village force schools to do something different. You know, I hear people say all the time about how parents are absent and, you know, they don't check on their kids, et cetera. That hasn't changed any. It's no more or no less than when we were kids.
Right.
That's just fact. The only difference is that everybody knows about everything because it's on social media. Right. That's it. Right?
But
the
completely.
Same lack of involvement in education when we were kids is the same thing now. People sent their kids to school expecting to get an education and come home. Right?
Right.
I think that our job, those of us who have the time and energy, and et cetera, we need to be the village for every baby in the building.
Right. Right.
And we need to be advocating for ways to engage parents who don't have the time, opportunity, or space to engage. Right? And we need to be having more conversations about trauma, because this is trauma. This is traumatic.
This is traumatic. Right?
Like, after Katrina, you know, the Katrina babies are 14 now. No, I'm sorry. The Katrina babies are 19 now, right?
Yeah. They would have graduated this year or last year. Last year.
Right. They would have graduated this year or last year. Like, and I don't think we've ever had enough mental health professionals in this town, nor have we used ACEs, which is the way we like help figure out how kids are feeling, doing, or et cetera. Right. Mm-hmm. We just keep throwing things at Black children, like buck up, stand up. You can do it. Right?
Yes.
We're not asking white kids the same thing. We're not asking, you know, someone told a story yesterday about a young boy. Oh, Jason Williams is a city council person here who is, he's a city council person at large. He's running for the DA. Thank God. And he was telling a story about his client that he has as an adult. But this young man, when he was 7 years old, his brother got murdered, right? And he sat in the back of this car with his brother's blood all over him, right? And the next day was expected to be at school. Right?
Wow. And no one ever talked to him. No one ever dealt with that trauma.
And he ended up having a life, you know, having a very difficult life. But here's the point. Like, even us as Black parents, we do the same thing to our Black children. Yeah. Right? Because the world is so harsh and rough, et cetera. We tell them to get up, dust off, and keep it pushing.
We do.
When the truth is, we have our own trauma, and we're just passing that trauma down through DNA and action to our babies.
Yes.
And we need to give them the space to talk about it. And we need to give them the space to say, this doesn't work for me. Right? Like, this is what I don't like about this school. Of course, there's certain things that are going to be like, well, that's what you just have to do that.
Right. Right.
But if we don't start having different conversations with the people who teach them and listen to their experiences, then we're just going to get more of the same and it's just going to be worse. So I think this is an opportunity, a moment in time for us to call our schools to the carpet. You know, all these schools racing around right now to get culturally relevant pedagogy and equitable training. Right.
Right.
A lot of them, if you ask me, are just doing it to check a box. The same way that a lot of schools say they want Black men to teach, but want them to be a certain way. right? You got a certain box. You got to, you know, Teach for America is a large part of who, you know, who is training and teaching teachers. Right. And they do a great job in some ways, but in other ways they struggle. And if you ask me, the one way they struggle is in expecting everybody to fit this Teach for America model, right? And Black men are not a monolith. They have different experiences. They don't all go to Harvard. They don't all come from top 25 schools. Mm-hmm. You know, they come from around the way. They might have been arrested. They might have a record, right?
Right.
But those are all valuable things that they and tools that they can use in a classroom to connect with kids who have uncles who've been locked up, parents who've been murdered, right? Siblings who've been taken away, right?
Right. Right.
People have been raised by their PD and their uncle rather than mom and daddy, right? But if we don't have those people in classrooms and we keep saying, oh, we're just going to get Black versions of white people and put them in there.
Sorry.
Roger's cracking up because we literally just had this conversation because of his 10 years in education. And he basically was like, you know, I don't always fit the mold of what they want me to be as an educator. Well, he's actually a counselor. But even then, it's like, you know, people throw kids in him and be like, fix them. And it's like, I can't fix them.
Because as working in broader education, I was working as a SAPIS counselor. And they will give me kids with that come into school with a wad of $1,000 bills in his hand. And then you want me to talk to him about graduation? No, he's making money already.
He's making more than you.
He's making more than your salary. The only reason he's coming in here is because he's underage. He needs someplace to go. So then I had to appeal to, I can't talk to him about graduation. I got to do the reverse with him. I got to talk to him, okay, you're making money now, but in your corporation, because they know all used to sell drugs and all that stuff, so I understood the business of in your corporation, you're going to hire people with PhDs, and you should know what these people are doing with your money. And they go,
right,
okay, Mr. Maloney, so I need you, I used to physically counsel kids in the hallway because the principal I have, and you could talk about principals too, the principal I had was weird. Like, in terms of weird, she just came in and was like dismantling all the stuff that the previous principal did to make this, put the school back on track. And because I was never allowed to be in the classroom because they figured the social emotional curriculum wasn't needed at the time. It's so funny. So now I'm talking to kids, literally, I just tell kids, yo, let's get in the elevator real quick. I got 12 of y'all. So let me tell you what you have to do. The reason why I want you to go to math class is because when you run your corporation, you're going to need this math class. And they will laugh, right, and they will get it. We have to do different ways of educating and teaching those type of kids. And it worked.
It does work. And here's the unfortunate thing. We don't make space for that, right? So we're talking to kids about things that don't connect for them and then wondering why they don't get it.
Right.
And it may not even be they don't get it. They just don't care because you haven't said anything that connected with them, right? But we don't make space for you to be able to have a conversation and be like, I know that's what you're doing. So let's talk about it like it's a corporation. I'm never going to use any of those terms, et cetera, but I'm going to talk about like this. If you were running a business, this is what you have to do because that connects for them, right? They may not grad, they may drop out, but they may decide to go get their GED later, right?
Mm-hmm.
They may decide to go to community college at some point because you had that conversation with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we don't make space for that. And so many times Black men enter into a school and it's like, we don't believe they can be intellectual leaders.
Mm.
So we make them the disciplinarian. What'd you say? Every kid that they didn't know what to do with, they threw them at you. Here, take this, fix that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, we believe Black men are Superman, right? But on the other hand, we don't believe they have the intellectual capacity to improve the academic growth of children.
What I noticed is that they like the idea of a Black man who's in the school. He's right in the building. He's like the go-to guy. He's like the guy. He didn't even say a word yet. He's just like, oh, this guy may connect with these Black kids. And then that's like a checkbox for most educators. Like, for them, I used to do lessons about, hey, what happens one day? It's so funny. This was 2018 before the school, high school shut down. I was like, what happens if y'all can't come to school? I was literally having that conversation. I was prophetic. I was on some next Matrix stuff. I was like, yo, suppose y'all couldn't come to school and, you know, we had to do this educational system at home. He said, well, how would y'all like it? The kids was like, oh, we would love it. If we could do this on our phones, it'll be amazing.
Mm-hmm. And look where we are now.
And most schools have these smart boards. And everybody and the teachers never use the smart boards to its fullest capacity. Those smart boards have the ability to do all the Zoom calls. One school that a friend of mine ran, he used to do his Zoom calls, but they used to use the smart boards to talk to kids in Japan. Most teachers will turn on a smart board and work them like chalkboards. And that's it. But they could do so much more if they would just turn on their Wi-Fi.
Right. Right. But here's the thing. We give teachers smart boards and say, you know, in a lot of schools, smart board doesn't even work anymore.
They don't even work.
And part of it is because people are not trained on how the innovative ways they can use it, et cetera. Right. So we put massive technology in a building and then we underutilize it or don't use it correctly at all. And so what's the purpose of that? You know? I don't know how many teachers I've heard be in a teacher meeting where they just feel like they're just in there to listen to the principal drone on and on and on about what didn't go right, what needs to be different, you know, beating the hammer, right? And then in addition to that, let's not even talk about professional development.
Oh boy.
All professional development. Schools spend on an average in a year $18,000 per teacher on PD, right? 70% of that PD fails. Because it is essentially a box that's checked off. It's one day of professional development, or it's the same doggone PD you do every year where you learn absolutely nothing new and you're just there to sign your name on the sheet, right?
Yes.
So to me, that we got a lot of work to do. We need to make space for teachers who don't fit the, you know, white female suburban mold.
Right.
Or the black version of the white female suburban mold, right? We need to treat teachers like professionals and give them a plethora of options when it comes to professional development based on, you know, both observation as professionals, but also on things that the teachers feel like they want to know. And we also have to have these conversations about culture that are happening in schools.
Right.
Like, what are the ways that we are perpetuating trauma in this building, mm-hmm. not only for the children, but for the people, the individuals who work here? And how do we heal so that we can move forward? And schools, I get that we're pressured about tests. I get all of those things, right? But in this moment where we see the movement for Black lives in the streets across the country, including in the little old town of Poughkeepsie where I grew up, right? Educators need to do the same thing.
Right.
You know, like we need to have a list of demands about what we want if we're gonna return to school in the fall. And whatever way that looks like, even if it's just partial, you're in school part of the week and you're at home the other part of the week, whatever it is. But we can't just keep letting it happen like this.
I know one of the big issues here, and both of my girls went to charter schools, was keeping teachers, you know, in the schools for longer than a year, longer than 2 years. Can you talk a little bit about that in New Orleans and how does that affect your fellows? How long are your fellows usually, once they get through the program, how long have they stayed? What are their challenges? You know, can you speak to those things?
Sure. So, you know, for a number of years, about 80% of our graduating fellows would go into the classroom. I can tell you now that the longest tenured teacher is probably 3.5 years.
Okay.
Right? So we are not keeping them longer in classrooms. But what I think, maybe we are because the average teacher is staying for 2, right? But I will say this, the impact of the work we do is far reaching beyond them being in the classroom a long time. So they, you know, there's 3 years that they're with us, right? So there's 3 years of impact of them being with young people in classrooms, and we keep them in the same schools they've been in whenever possible for those 3 years. I think the impact for them is that they see how important it is for them to be involved in the lives of young people, right?
So when they transition out of the classroom, they don't necessarily go to, they don't go to corporate America, right? You know, like I have a young man who was in the classroom. He's now getting his PhD at LSU. He's a teaching assistant. He's helping a bunch of young undergrads because LSU has like 6% black students or something. He's helping a bunch of young undergrads navigate being at LSU, right?
Wow. So
he's in higher ed. We have another young man who, you know, we have a lot of Xavier University students, and Xavier is a HBCU here mm-hmm. in New Orleans, turns out the highest number of black doctors in the country. And so we've had a number of young people who were in pre-med who chose to do a 2-year gap year, right, where they decided to go teach. Awesome. And then they went back to graduate school and they're teaching assistants. We've had people start Boy Scout troops. We've had people start rites of passage organizations. We've had a couple of young men become fathers during undergrad. And because of their experience with us, they have learned how to navigate some of their own trauma to be really great involved fathers, right?
Wow.
Those are all the benefit. Those are all the things that we do because we're not just addressing the individual. We're not just treating this as like a pipeline to teaching. It is a pipeline to teaching, right? But the ultimate goal is to help these young men find themselves, connect to something bigger themselves, and see their impact beyond college, right? You know, a lot of our young folks have gone to our first one of, we call the first group of bros, the original bros.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the young men just became as a full time physician now. He just is in his residency in Rochester.
Wow.
And he posted that his time with Brothers in Power to Teach meant so much to him. And that, you know, the Latin interpretation of the word doctor comes from the idea of teacher. And so he sees himself as a teacher, even though he's not in a traditional role. So those are the benefits of this thing. And by the way, we also have black women in Brothers in Power to Teach, which is a whole another conversation.
Right. in terms of equity, right? I'm sure they were knocking on your door.
No, actually, we stumbled upon it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so what happened was we inherited a program in Baton Rouge. We got asked to come to Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge trying to figure out how to increase the number of black teachers, et cetera. And but the program was called the Tutor Corps and it was being run by an intermediary in Baton Rouge. And they sort of were like, well, this isn't really what we plan to do, but we wanted to see, like, if we put this money somewhere and we incentivize folks to consider education, what would happen, right? So the Tutor Corps would happen to be all black women. And so they had enough money for 20 seats in a fellowship. So we split it. We had 10 seats for Brothers in Power to Teach fellows and 10 for Tutor Corps. And so in Baton Rouge, we had 10 young men and 10 women.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And what we found was Dr. Lisa Delpit, who was considered the godmother of, one of the godmothers of cultural pedagogy, said, you guys have stumbled on something great. You are putting black men in a space that is purposely working to be anti-racist and anti-sexist. And by having young women in the program, it kind of forces us to have some conversations we might not otherwise have, mm-hmm. right? So as time has gone on, we don't, it's not 50-50 anymore. We have 30% of the seats that can go to young women, right? Or young folks who identify as female. But what we have seen is it requires the young women in the program to have some reflection on the ways they show up with young women, right?
Interesting.
And by having them think about that in this space with their peers, it also impacts how they show up with young girls in classrooms, right?
Yes.
And because they're peers, they have these different conversations they might not otherwise have. And I also think it's really beneficial to women because here's the reality. Black men in educational spaces need allies and women need to be their allies.
Yes.
And particularly black women need to be black men's allies in these schools that are mostly white, right?
Mm.
And the only way for black women to become those allies is to be in a space that is dedicated to black men and be not necessarily forced, but have to hear their side of the story, right?
Mm.
And hear what is impacting them and why they're confused about certain things. And the things that we do as women to perpetuate the patriarchy in ways that confuse men. They're like, well, y'all show up like X, Y, and Z. So what am I supposed to do? You know?
Mm.
And so, you know, my co-founder always worries that, you know, having women in space might, they might overpower the conversation.
Because you know how Black women do.
Right. But I think we do a good job of kind of managing the conversations, because as a part of the work, we have this thing called the Cypher Series, which Larry came up with the idea of creating spaces for the young people to talk about things that affect their personal and professional trajectory. Mm-hmm. And I suggested we call it the Cypher because Larry and I basically bonded over our love of hip hop, right?
Yes.
So that's how we really got started. And so the Cypher, we have these rules to try to like make sure that we make space for the young women, but don't let them necessarily overpower the space. And at the same time, make sure the men don't kind of dump some of their patriarchy, some of their things on them without having to like explore it or ask the question, like, why do you think that? Mm-hmm. What gives you that? What, why do you think that? You know what I mean? And then when you hear your fellow bros say something crazy about women in space, because you were surrounded by your fellow bros, they can be like, bro, I know you didn't just say that.
Right.
Right? You know what I mean?
They check each other.
They check each other. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, I feel like one of the things that is going to have to happen besides the education of our children is the sort of re-education of all of us in terms of what's happening now in our society. And I feel like, you know, we're all going to need to go back to school in some form or fashion, however, whatever school looks like, for people to kind of undo. I feel like, I mean, the way you describe it, you're working, you're undoing for the fellows, you're undoing sort of their education and giving them a new paradigm that they will then perpetuate on the youth that they teach. And mm-hmm. that's gonna, I mean, it's gonna have to happen, you know, at multiple levels. You know, I realized that I was telling a friend yesterday that, you know, for the past 5 years, you know, I've been posting Happy Juneteenth on my Facebook sort of as a FU to people who just didn't even know what Juneteenth is. And you know, this Friday that passed, you know, my whole timeline was Happy Juneteenth from Blacks and whites. And I didn't know how to take it. I was like overcome, as well as like, well, what's going to be my next FU to
right.
everybody? And my friend, she was like, well, that means you just have to keep pushing. Like, you know, we've gotten like one, you know, minuscule step into understanding, you know, the history of this country. You know, you're going to have to keep pushing. And I was like, okay, because, you know, I felt like my fight was taken away from me.
I wasn't expecting
people to kind of finally get a little bit of it. It was a really interesting
Well, as my father said the other day, he's like, you know, if this like blowing up of Juneteenth into this big deal makes more Black folks love being Black, then we have done something amazing.
Yes.
And like you, I recognize Juneteenth every year, and I'm glad that I'm glad to see people recognizing it. And you know, I had a conversation with Larry the other day, and he was like, he was worried about this whole bandwagon idea, right?
Because he's a rebel. Proud to be a rebel in Larry.
And, all this stuff. And we've been a Black-led organization, being Black yeah. for a minute. And he's like, I don't know how to feel about it. And we were listening to Ebro's podcast, and Ebro was like, you know, it takes many. People want to get on the bus, and they're willing to go where the bus is going, mm-hmm. then let them get on the bus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's like, now, the people get on the bus and cut up. You put them off the bus.
Right.
But so I appreciate that. But I hope that what does not get lost in this fight is that like education is the civil rights issue of all of the things, right?
Humanity.
Our criminal justice system is full of Black and brown bodies, right? If you look at the data, is a lot of those young people were in foster care, mm-hmm. right? They had trauma or death or murder in their family, right? They dropped out of school,
mm-hmm.
right? Why did they drop out of school? Because nobody recognized their trauma that they were going through. They didn't have stable housing. They probably didn't have stable income, mm-hmm. right? They lost somebody who was taking care of them. They had to take care of themselves, right?
Yes.
Yes, there are many who also had the life of like one foot in the street and one foot in academics because of the communities they grew up in, right? But men like Roger can reach young men who are living that life by turning the conversation on his head, mm-hmm. right? But if you have no point of reference to be able to turn that conversation on its head, either because you grew up around it or because you listened to all the hip hop or your friends or whatever, you know what I mean? Then you can't have that conversation.
Right.
Right. One of the things that my work inspired for this work from my grandfather, who was a 35-year educator in the Cleveland public school systems. And when the crack epidemic hit in Cleveland, it turned the entire school system upside down, just like it did in New York. Right. Mm. But my grandfather stuck to his guns about helping young people find a pathway to success, whatever that pathway might be. He recognized it might not be college for some folks.
Right.
It might be trade school. He recognized some folks might drop out of school, but like, Roger, I'm going to have a conversation with you about how to think about this business you're running, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully influence you to think differently down the road, right?
Right.
And when he passed away, scores of people came to his funeral to say, or to his, you know, wake to say, you know, Sam Jones impacted my life in so many ways. I'm a master mechanic now. I started an AC business. I run the printing press. It's a plain dealer. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't start making ways for people to feel like humans yes. inside classrooms who are leading them yes. and the humans who sit in front of them matter, then what have we really done?
Mm. Absolutely nothing.
Because we can't go back to the way it was.
We can't. We definitely can't. Another thing I was recently challenged with, another organization I'm on the committee, which is like a local board, is Young Lives. It's a Christian organization that people who are ministers walk alongside kids from the farthest reaches. These kids who are lost and feel like they don't belong anywhere, or, you know, their situation has them in places where they're hopeless, and they go into schools and do ministry work. So I'm on the local board here in Harlem, and I also volunteer with the girls group for high school here. And the young ladies challenged our group about creating a Black history curriculum. And we had a long discussion about what was going on, the George Floyd, the Breonna Taylor, and they had some really strong views. But in them, my question to them are like, how do we fix this for you? They were like, well, you need to fix it by changing the curriculum. And I was like, I kind of clutched my pearls because I wasn't expecting that. Mm-hmm. Not sure why I wasn't expecting that, but these young ladies are sharp. And they were challenging, they were asking the facilitator, a woman I facilitate with, who is there, she does college prep, she's a counselor with them, mm-hmm. they were like, how do we attend a school that is 95% Black, people of color, you know, African-Americans, Latinos, and there's no Black history curriculum? And we were silent. Like, we were like, you know? You're right. So I challenged them. One of the things we're going to work on over the summer is to create one. And one that they're going to challenge their principal with. And we're going to start with like letter writing and trying, because they're also a charter. I feel like they're at the best advantage to build one and create and use it. And how Black history, they want to do it not just for one class, but how Black history is weaved into every subject. And I was like, ladies, that's a tall order, and I'm ready to do it with you.
Yeah.
So I ask you, like, how do you guys plan to try to initiate things like that within the curriculum for your bras to introduce into classrooms? Or what do you see about Black history curriculums?
So I'm going to start here. We have 15 charter schools led by Black people in New Orleans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And while I appreciate that they decided to make Juneteenth a holiday on Friday, I am equally frustrated by the fact that it took a bunch of white folks writing letters and saying, hey, Juneteenth, for these Black charter leaders to say, we're going to officially recognize Juneteenth, right?
Mm.
Now, of course, they did it before the rest of the charters in New Orleans, so one could say they are leading from the front. Some could say that. But the fact is that, like, you have an 85% Black and brown school district. You have 15 schools that are led by Black folks, and we should be doing exactly what these students are demanding. And that was further driven home for me when we took our fellows to Foxfire Ranch in Waterford, Mississippi, which is about 45 minutes northwest of Memphis. Mm-hmm. The Foxfire Ranch is owned by the Hollowell family, and it is Black owned land. They've owned it since 1909.
What? Wow.
And so we took our fellows there, and we also took them to Memphis to the National Civil Rights Museum, which is where the Lorraine Motel is. Mm-hmm. And the morning of the trip of us taking the bus ride to Memphis, Larry and I took money out of our own pocket, and we said to them, name three Black civil rights icons who are not Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, or somebody else we said. Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. The most disheartening thing is to stand in front of a group of college students, a significant number who go to HBCUs, and them struggle to name somebody. Mm-hmm. Because we ask them to name them and tell them what they're known for, right? So like, and they just kept naming first. And I was like, this is how they're learning about Black history.
Yes.
They're constantly learning about the first. So they say Thurgood Marshall. And they say, well, he was the first Supreme Court justice. Well, that's not what Thurgood Marshall is best known for. Mm-hmm. He was the lawyer for the NAACP.
Right.
All those things, right? You know what I mean? Somebody said Ella Baker, but couldn't tell me why Ella Baker. I said, oh, because she's the man behind Martin Luther. She is the woman behind Martin Luther King. She was the executive director of SNCC. She did all these things. She is the movement. She is the mother of the movement, right?
Right.
They don't know any of this
stuff. They don't know.
And when one of the students said, this has made it clear that we don't know any of this stuff and y'all didn't teach it to us.
Oh, how do you expect us to know?
Wow, they were like, we didn't hear none of this in school. We don't talk about it, blah, blah, blah. It's like, you know, this class, it's an elective at Southern and da-da-da-da-da, wow. Right? And I was like, this is why you constantly hear me and Larry telling you about these different things that are happening with Black people,
right,
and challenging you to think about history and asking you to get involved. And we turned it back on them and said, now this may be true that in high school you didn't learn, elementary school you didn't learn, but now you're in college and you know that you didn't learn and you're standing in front of me telling you don't know. So what are you going to do about it? And how are we going to help you do something about it? You know, but like, this is what it takes. And there's, it's easy to weave. In some ways, it's easy to weave.
Yes.
Black excellence throughout every subject in school. Right. First is using examples that are culturally relevant.
Right.
Second is picking texts that are culturally diverse. Right.
Right.
Third is using the current technology and the current way that students talk, et cetera, in the day. Right. The third thing is like teaching them how to code switch and not making them feel bad because they have their own language.
Yes.
Wow. You know what I mean? Like, I can speak to someone in New Orleans and use all the slang that I need to use, and they'll be like a little confused because I sound like a New Yorker using New Orleans slang.
Right. Right? I'm sure. I'm sure.
But I can also go to New York and speak to a young person in New York and use the same slang and whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. I can show up in a boardroom in New Orleans and speak whatever way I need. And those right. are benefits. But we keep selling Black kids on the language you use at home and in the street is unacceptable.
No, it's not.
It's a skill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you might one day be a community developer. You might be an urban planner. You might be a banker. And you need to talk to Miss May in a way that Miss May understands.
Yes.
And if you can't, you can't connect.
Wow. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel like this is the conversation we need to have. That's what I was alluding to a little earlier. Like, you know, while we are on this movement, and it is a movement, you feel it. I'm like, I'm ready to have the internal conversation. We don't have to do it publicly, but right. there are a lot of things that we as Black people need to unpack for ourselves that don't even have to do and unlearn. And I was telling a friend who came over, a white friend who came and hung out with us on Friday. It was more coincidence than anything, but she was in town. She lives in Yonkers and was in Harlem. She's actually the youth ministry leader at our church. And having a conversation with her, like, we joked, like, we should have recorded that conversation because it was deep. And she's someone I love deeply. and we take family vacations together. We're going to do more. And we got to have a real conversation on Friday. And one of the things I had shared with her was that, you know, and I'm sure as well as you, grew up with the, you know, we have to be twice as good to get half of what white people get. And, you know, you're born with two strikes, you're Black and you're a woman. So it already sets you back, but it means you have to work harder. And I said, one of the things in this movement for me personally is that I was not going to do that to my children. You know, mm-hmm. Society-wise, you know, others might see their Blackness and their womanness as a strike. I'm teaching my girls and my son that their humanity is what is going to propel them forward. You know, teaching them to be Christians, small C, not big C, less colonial, and that, you know, there's no strikes here. Like, the only strike against you is what you failed to procure for yourself in terms of your education and your creativity and how you want to develop your life. Like, I don't want to have that lack conversation any longer. Not if I expect them to not hold this burden that we've been carrying for over 400 years.
Right.
And that's right. What's going to set them apart. Like, one of the things we did as parents is we experimented on our kids. I've talked about this in other episodes, and I'm going to do more, especially we were fortunate to be able to do it in the charter system, which I think that's why we went charter. Both girls went to dual language academies. Sienna went to a French charter school. Devin Rose went to a Hebrew language charter school. So they both speak other languages. And to me, people ask, like, what? Why French? Why not Spanish? Mm-hmm. Being that we're in New York, and, you know, if you're not English, you're Spanish in some form. And, you know, why Hebrew? That the biggest thing was why Hebrew. And I was like, why not? Like, you know, a lot of people don't know there is a pretty dynamic Jewish community here in Harlem. And it's actually mm-hmm. historical. The Jewish community has been in Harlem.
Between 96th Street and, right, yeah.
Forever. They were there
right.
Forever.
They were there before.
They were kind of here first. And
right.
We started exactly. to co-opt the land and live together. You know, I work at a Jewish organization now, and even unpacking, like, the history between Blacks and Jews is a conversation. Woo, baby, that is going to be a really deep conversation when we really start to have it. And my organization is trying to do something about having that conversation. But I'm like, why shouldn't my children learn a second language other than Spanish? No shade to Spanish. You know, I want them to learn Spanish as well. They kind of can learn it by osmosis, by, you know, virtue of being New Yorkers. But, right. you know, we...
And with Sienna speaking French, it'll be easier for her to understand anyway.
She's an A student in her Spanish class. And they're like, do you speak Spanish at home? She's like, no. We are nowhere near Latino. But, you know, it was easy to pick up the language because her early second language was French. She started in kindergarten. So I always mm-hmm. kind of pat myself on the back for that social experiment I did with my kids. And it brought in their horizons. Sienna school was very mixed when it started in terms of French from France, Africans from the Francophonie countries, and the African-Americans here as well in Harlem. So their school started on a great trajectory. They had their issues, which I'm sure you deal with changing principals, changing administrations, boards being mm-hmm. too aggressive. Like, they went through it all and they finally stabilized. Devin Rose's school did the same thing. The Hebrew charter, it started in Brooklyn in the ultra Orthodox community. And then they wanted to broaden the education system and allow for other students. And that's how she got into that school. They're going through transition again for the same thing. And I would definitely love to have you back with other charter educators, because that's a big issue with the turnover is what ruins a school to me. And, you know, we can talk ad nauseum about the do's and the don'ts of that. But I do appreciate what they got in the beginning, that set a foundation for, like, they're used to being in schools where there are multiple groups of people. And, you know, they don't feel less than because they're the only Black. We also thought about doing a private school thing. And it was my daughter, it was Sienna, who was like, I don't want to go to a school with all white people. No shade to white people, but she was like, I don't want to be the only one. And that kind of struck me because I didn't even think she was that aware. You know, go ahead.
I think that I think one of the biggest mistakes we make as adults is that we don't think children are aware. Mm-hmm. They're highly aware, mm-hmm. and they're highly intuitive, and they soak up all the things, right? So, you know, like, I get it that some parents are like, well, I don't really want to talk to my kids about what's happening right now. And I'm like, but you have to.
You have to.
Because they're hearing it. They're hearing your conversation, overhearing your conversation in the kitchen. They're overhearing the conversations on the street. They're overhearing the news in the background. They're processing the information, right? They deserve to have a conversation. You have to figure out how to have an age-appropriate conversation with them. But kids are going to bed with anxiety at night.
Anxiety.
Because they don't know what's going on, right? Yes. Because we're like, oh, well, don't tell them anything. They'll be fine. No. They don't live in a bubble, right? And they need to know what's happening. And they also are very aware of what's happening with them in school. You mm-hmm. know, like, I went to a 99.8% white high school. Mm-hmm. Me and Erica McCormick, when we moved from New York, the city, to Poughkeepsie, me and Erica McCormick were the only two Black people in our whole neighborhood.
Wow.
We're only two Black families in the whole neighborhood, and there had to be at least 120 houses in the neighborhood, right? Yeah, that's traumatic.
Traumatic.
Right? That is traumatic. Even if, you know, in retrospect, I don't think I really felt like I was surrounded by racists in some ways, but I remember Mrs. Lashaway, my fourth grade teacher. She was horrible. I almost failed the fourth grade. She was a mean and terribly spirited woman. She was probably racist. No, I don't. She probably wasn't. She definitely was racist because it's only me, James, and this other Black girl in that class. And some reason, we were always the ones in trouble, right?
Mm.
Then there is, you know, there's the girl who I was friends with, Jackie Schraff. If she's listening to this podcast, I'm sorry that I'm about to hurt your feelings, but when I was in the fourth grade, you know, my dad worked for IBM, right?
Right.
So, and he's a tech guy. So we had a Beta VCR and a VHS VCR, and he had this fancy sound system.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jackie used to come over and hang out. And Jackie's dad, Jackie came to me one day and said, asked me if my father was a drug dealer.
Oh.
This just goes to prove how much children listen, because yes. Jackie's father didn't say that to her. Jackie's father was a New York police officer. And he said to Jackie's mom, how the Negroes, the Joneses, had all this fancy technology? He drives a Volvo on. He must be a drug man.
You were the literal Joneses.
Right. We were the literal Joneses, right? Yes. But Jackie didn't come up with that out of her
mouth. Nope, she did not.
Right? She overheard an adult say that. So therefore she asked, right? So, like, you making these decisions about what school and how and when and, you know, the things you want them to learn and collect. My parents did the same for me. I went to a 99% white high school, but at my middle school mm-hmm. was like 60% Black and brown people.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the middle of town. I walked to my best friend's house all the time. Like, I learned to be a city kid mm-hmm. hanging out with my best friend Val and mm-hmm. her siblings, right? But my mother, her thing was, I didn't want you to forget you were Black.
Right.
Or not have an appreciation of being Black and, like, feel like you have to fit into this proximity of whiteness. So we sent you to this diverse school.
Right.
Right. And we do have to start speaking life into Black children instead of fear. Because we speak a lot of fear in them. They can't do this. They can't go there. They can't walk around the corner. If I hear one more Black person tell me they beat their child so the cops won't beat them, mm-hmm. I'm going to scream. Because the cops are still beating your child.
Still beating. And may kill them.
And they're still shooting your child in the back. Mm-hmm. And instead, that child is walking around with fear and trauma and anxiety, right?
Yes.
And a sense of a rebellious spirit that could actually get them killed because right. they're full of anger.
Right.
You know? So this internal conversation that Black folks have to starts with, like, can we stop preaching fear into our children?
Completely.
We can teach them how to be cautious and aware and street smart, but we don't have to make them afraid, right?
Right?
And also, can we stop with the respectability politics
thing? Oh my God. About
this black kid is better than this black kid because they speak the King's English and they went to Jack and Jill or whatever.
Yes.
Right?
I even have to do it. So my girls go to a camp that is called the Broadway, and they do, it's for girls, and they do leadership through theater and the arts. And we came across the organization through Sienna's middle high school. Now she's going into high school, which actually was the first, I believe it was the first charter school in New York City, the Young Women's Leadership School. And she, they've offered us a lot of things that, you know, I wish other schools would do, do the same. She plays squash, which we got introduced through her school organization called Street Squash here in Harlem, and there's one in Newark, and they brought in our horizons. I say ours because I knew what squash was, but I had never seen it played or demonstrated. And now, you know, she competes and they travel. I'm also on the parent board there. But one of the things that A Broader Way was started by Idina Menzel, who is famous for Rent and Wicked, mm-hmm. and she takes young black and brown girls out of the city. They go to Bard at Simon Rock, which is up in the Berkshires, and every summer, and they stay for almost 10 days, and they like, we have no contact with them other than like a note that they send every 2 days that they're alive, and they come back enriched. Sienna, this is her third year, Devin Rose's second year, and they love it. And one of the things, though, they were challenged with last summer was Sienna is on a little lighter hue. Devin Rose is my chocolate dumpling. And mm-hmm. the kids were surprised. The girls were surprised that they were related. And they kept asking them if they had the same mother and father. Mm. And Devin Rose was troubled. I've never seen her troubled about her color, her skin color, because she's really brown. And, you know, I had to like do a lot of undoing conversations about colorism. And we've been talking about that a lot in our home. And, you know, that's one of the main conversations that us folks have to really, really deal with in our community. And I mean, that if there's no education to be had, the colorism conversation is probably the one, the biggest one we have to deal with. And, you know, trying to make sure that they don't see each other as different. I say, you know, we come in different hues. You look at our family, like, you know, my mom is very fair and, you know, my uncle's very dark. And like that took all summer to undo. And I was like, Lord, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want that to be, but we see how that perpetuates in society in terms of education, in terms of job, in terms of, you know, people's perception of, you know, intellect. And it really troubles me how that's a big, big, big problem in our community. And, yes, and education is a big thing too.
Absolutely. It is definitely a big thing. And I, you know, our podcast producer was just asking us to make a list of topics for our next 5 podcasts. And I just decided that one of them should be, that I should write on the list is colorism.
Take it, girl. Do it. Do it.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Because, you know, education, I think it plays out a lot. You know, if the trauma, you know, isn't, you know, if the trauma isn't, you know, murder in the community and poverty, colorism is so insidious, particularly in education, that it almost has a life of its own. And, you know, we're, you know, I did notice, like, in even in Devin Rose's school, as progressive as they tried to be, you know, she's like, I'm always in trouble. And yep. And I'm like, you know, what is that? And I had to kind of narrow it down where she would be, you know, my Devin Rose is very spirited. That's the word I'm going to use. And she, you know, her group of friends, you know, she tends to attract the spirited group of people. So I did see that some of that was happening where a friend of hers was Latino and same behavior, but wasn't getting in trouble the same way. And I was like, uh-oh, I got to address this. And I challenged the teacher. I didn't call it what it was, but I was like, you know, if they're all doing wrong, they all have to receive the same punishment. And if they're all doing right, they all have to receive the same reward. And I realized that, you know, it's something she's going to struggle with unless we as a community deal with it. Or people favoring Sienna over mm-hmm. Devin Rose because she's lighter. Or people assuming Sienna's not even Black. A lot of people in the French school, they always expected Roger to be a white man coming in because mm-hmm. they associated my, you know, butter pecan Rican looking child to be mixed. And I'm like, right. No, Black people come in all shades. All shades. Right. And, you know, let's be real about it. The reason we have some light skinned folk is because of slavery. So let's have that conversation. I don't know if people are even ready to deal with that conversation. But, you know, that's for another time. But, you know, education is the key to all of this. And you and Larry, to me, are doing God's work. I've said this to you before. You're doing real ministry work, because that is where, I mean, you educate someone, you are literally changing their trajectory. You're changing the neurons in their brain and creating a new life for not only themselves, but the generations after them. And that's a tall order. And so my next question to you is, what's your self-care, sis? Because you're doing some heavy lifting.
Well, speaking of heavy lifting, we're getting ready to launch this culturally relevant pedagogy. That's my job.
Okay.
I'm actually stepping down from Brothers in Power to teach in the next few months to run a for-profit venture that will be partners with Brothers in Power to teach, but I'll get to run my own show. Because, you know, I'm sure that, you know, you and Roger have been doing this podcast together, but it's interesting when you're partners running a business. You know, Larry and I were dating. We're not dating anymore, but we continue to mm-hmm. do that business together. And so it'll be good to have our own lane.
Yes.
And I think it's important to take that next level of work that we're doing. You know, like you just said, it's a ministry, but we can't keep putting Black men in poison wells, right? And if we keep putting them in these schools the way they are, and without the schools actually confronting how they perpetuate bias and nonsense, then it's just a futile act, really. So there's that. Now, your question about self-care. My self-care routine is that I work out 5 days a week. I have a trainer that I work out with 3 days of those five. I'm doing this 21-day boot camp with Girl Trek on Black History. And every day they feature another amazing Black woman who's done amazing things. And I do my 30-minute meditation walk with them. I do meditate relatively regularly. And, you know, I'm a praying woman, so I do that too. I tend to, before COVID, I would be like, all right, I got to go. And I would bounce. I'd go on a trip somewhere, you know. So that has sort of been my self-care routine. But, you know, I haven't been sleeping well the last couple of months. I used to, and I, through meditation and then exercise, I had started sleeping pretty regularly, 8 hours a night. But I haven't been sleeping well. And so these last couple of weeks, I've just been like trying to sleep. And I appreciate the Foxfire Ranch. I went there this weekend to hang out with my friend Annette for Big Mama's MFing birthday. And there was a blues show there. And I don't know why, but I slept like a baby on the ranch. Mm-hmm. So now I seem to be getting back to sleeping. So I'm trying to make sure I get my regular sleep.
That is so important. Sleep is a friend, but sometimes it's not a good friend, because I don't get enough of it.
Right. You know, and you really do need that 8 hours. You need that 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep. I know for years I'd be like, oh, I only need 5 or 6. No, you need 8. You just need 8 hours. So, you know, get your 8 hours of sleep. And it's kind of like you were talking about Sienna, you know, growing over the last few months. And like her needing 15 hours of sleep, you know, I had to remind my brother. He was like, your niece sleeps all the time. She's 15. I said, because she's growing. And she needs sleep. So that's why when she's not doing schoolwork, you know, she's sleeping. you know,
it's I call it cocooning. Yeah. Like they are literally, because she was a real bug last year. Mm-hmm. And you know, between 12 and 13, I was like, oh my god, she is really going through an ugly phase. And you know, Roger will joke, he was like, I feel like every time she sleeps she grows. And I was looking at pictures recently, and it literally, like, she has shed that little body and become a woman. And I'm like, when did that happen? It literally happened during All I Sleep. Yes. These chicks can sleep all day.
Right. And they'd be all worried. They'd be like, oh my goodness, is she depressed? I'd be like, no, she's 15. Yes. She's a mess. You know?
They don't need medication. They need sleep. They need sleep. They truly need sleep. Well, I'm sure your brother may not be quite grateful, you know, for you to have that wisdom, but thank God for aunties to protect them.
Yes.
Sometimes we're like, something's wrong with them. We need to fix them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, well, you know, my mama bear was really worried. She's like, oh my gosh, you sleep all the time. I was like, well, you know, part of this is just being a teenager and growing, mm-hmm. right? Like, and she's bored, yes. though, you know, but also she needs to sleep because she's growing. So, you know, I get it. You know, I think we have done this thing where we've like, because we live in America, it's all about production all the time.
Yes.
You must be producing. Like, we're in a pandemic, and the first month people are like, oh, I built a garden. Made a boat, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, that is great that we are at home and we're seeing these things, right? But it's also okay to recognize that the whole world as you know it has just
collapsed.
And you need a nap, you know? And what I'm hoping comes out of all of this for education and everything is that, like, we have seen what life can look like and how it can be better, and that we decide that that's how we're going to live our lives rather than this other way, which has not been helpful for any of us for a very long time.
Did you see the digital component being important in your new curriculum?
Yeah, actually, the reason that a few years ago, you know, Larry and I always had this idea about having technology involved, but it was kind of rudimentary. Like, it was kind of like, well, you know, we want a way for students to be able to communicate with each other. We want to be able to deliver the curriculum on an online platform for teachers outside of New Orleans. But we really had this idea about using artificial intelligence to create a virtual classroom. And when we talked about it 2.5 years ago, our tech mentor, Courtney, who started Torsh, T-O-R-S-H, which is a video platform for teacher observation, et cetera. At the time, he was like, dude, this AI is going to be incredibly expensive. It doesn't really exist right now. And it could be a great idea, but I don't know how we would pay for it, right? Well, now, fast forward 2.5 years later, there's a company that is building a virtual online classroom that they can create customized opportunities for you. So you can, like, you know, you can put yourself in a classroom with a teacher and have to respond to whatever's happening with the student. So you can have special needs student in there. It has, you know, English as a second language.
Wow. Okay.
Right. And so, yeah, we're looking forward to building that technology platform, and they are just getting out of the gate, so they're willing to let us be the guinea pig.
Awesome.
And we're willing to be the guinea pig. And then there's this other technology that's going to serve Brothers Empowered to Teach well, because our curriculum was built on the lab that we built for Brothers Empowered to Teach, which has both a personal and a professional development lens, right? So the cipher's about their personal development. And the development lab is about their professional development. And this year was the first year we rolled out the lab. But of course, COVID happened, so we didn't get to do the lab too, because everybody was trying to pivot. But there's also this new technology that allowed people to, like, do pre-work together and annotate articles together and have discussions and then bring them into the lab space. So I'm really excited about, you know, what's next, this partnership between the two and using technology to make it real.
Wow.
Right? Because I don't think we're going to move to a totally digital, nobody's in a building place, which is not, it's not possible. But I do think we're going to learn how to use technology in a more meaningful way.
Definitely. And I feel like those who were resistant, Roger and I speak in movie all the time. So we're like, the Borg is like upon us and resistance is futile, right? So, You know, if you didn't know about typing and, you know, trying to connect, you know, even my grandmother has learned how to Zoom. So, like, you know, we are past the point of like, there, you know, there's an excuse because you can Google it. And, you know, if you just need me to show you how, I will show you how. And that's where I laugh. Talking about like not understanding, you know, how resilient kids are. Like my two kind of learn how to hack their iPads that they got from the DOE so that they could play games. And the other one is doing the YouTube. Somehow the YouTube wasn't working. It was locked. I don't know what she did. And now she's like recording on her iPad. I'm like, okay, make sure you remember how to undo it in case we got to send these iPads back. But, you know, they are so, even the ones that don't have are, all you have to do is kind of put it in their hands and they will figure it out. And I'm like, do not underestimate these children at all. Like if people, you know, really, I'm not saying like give them the whole bag, but you know, sometimes when I'm struggling, I'm like, hey, come over here. Can you help me undo this or help me, you know, figure out the code? And they'll do it and they'll be like, Mom, I don't understand how you don't know that. And then I want to smack them. But I'm like, you know, I marvel at how quickly they can learn something and then, you know, move to the next. Other than digressing, what I want people to know is that you are a 501c3 organization. So if you can please tell us how we can support your work, you and Larry's work, and as well as the for-profit work, even, you know, I know that's an extension, but how can we support you in growing this great work you do?
First of all these foundations out there saying that they want to cut the check to Black people. So, you know, if there's a foundation listening to this podcast, cut a check.
Exactly.
The second thing is that you can go to our website, B like boy, E as in Edward, and number two, the letter T, .org, and donate there. I believe we're working on the setting up a recurring monthly donation there. So, you know, if you want to give us $20 a month, we greatly appreciate it. It goes directly to us offering these wonderful fellows a stipend for their time with us. And the other way is just to follow us on Instagram and Facebook and share with your friends and encourage them to support our work. So our Instagram handle is Real Bruhs, BRUHS, Teach. And that is also our Facebook handle. We do not really use Twitter, but we should.
I'm still trying to figure Twitter out too. I don't know. I think it's more of my personal thing. Like I'm afraid to put sort of all my words out there because I'm like, you put it out there, it does not disappear, but I'm going to figure it out. Maybe we'll figure it out together.
Yeah. I've been trying to use Twitter for my personal side. So, but I, you know, if I could just, I think there's an app that you can just post the same thing you post on Facebook mm-hmm. on Twitter. I think that might be what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so you don't have to repeat yourself. Just I said what I said.
I don't have to repeat myself. And I don't have to manage multiple platforms.
Exactly.
A brand.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. Right. Well, Christina, it has been a pleasure having you on After the Kids Go to Bed. I will have you back. And you guys also have your podcast.
Which
is To Ed with Love, right?
Yes. To Ed, like education.
To Ed with Love. And you guys have just relaunched and getting the word out there about this empowering work and how others can replicate. I mean, that's my last question to you. How do you see you replicating yourself?
So you
don't burn yourself
really
out.
Yeah, I think the first thing is that Brothers Empowered to Teach builds its sites based on the city where it's in, mm-hmm. right? So we don't expect you to start a chapter of Brothers Empowered to Teach in another place and it'd be like chapter in New Orleans, mm-hmm. right? Like we take Mardi Gras and Lundi Gras off. That's because we live in New mm-hmm. Orleans, right? But in other places they may observe other things. So we try to create a replication that mirrors the place and the culture of the place where it's going to be, right? So the way I think we get to replication is that, you know, Larry and I will have to help set the foundation in that new place, but then we have to identify folks, right? Who, we have to identify folks who are just as passionate about education, buy into the vision that we have, and help them create a site in their mm-hmm. city, mm-hmm. right? So kind of like the Planned Parenthood model where you have an
affiliate. Yes, yes.
And I think that that's probably the best way. But I think because we're still kind of a startup, because, you know, the first 5 years are really crucial because only one in five businesses right. will make it, right? So we are in year six, and usually even the one that was in the first five makes it year six, and they also mm-hmm. perish. If you can make it through year six, that's generally you're on your way. So it's really important for us, as we think, to be thoughtful about mm-hmm. where we're going. A place that has the resource and is really committed to getting more Black men in space, and is willing to put up some money right. for a pilot. You know, we can do a pilot in any city for as low as $200,000. Right, we get 20 fellows, two people that run the program, and we're off
okay.
to the races.
Okay.
And you know, that 180 really turned into like $1 million worth of
wow lessons, yes,
you know,
yes.
So that's what, you know, that I think that's how we get to replication, because we know that lots of organizations that are working on getting more Black men to teach, and they all have their different ways, but I think that we have a unique way of meeting people
right.
where they are,
right,
right. And I think that a lot of times, because we are a competitive country, right, we make things competitive
yes, Lord.
Instead of necessarily examining the whole person and saying, okay, you might not have this 2.5 GPA, right? But this conversation, this thing that you're doing, your passion, we're going to bring you in here and right. see what happens, right. right? That doesn't happen a lot. We do that. We expect to continue to do that wherever we are.
Well, we are here to support you in your growth and development in any way we can. And we're going to get that word out, because we got to keep cis in a particular standard. And I so appreciate you and appreciate our friendship. And we will have you back.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I really enjoyed being on this podcast.
Was amazing.
I know Roger just let us go. He's been like, he's been making all kinds of faces, like, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta know when to, you gotta know when to be Robin and let Batman drive.
Right, exactly. You know, exactly. I appreciate y'all. I appreciate what you do, and I'm really grateful to be on your podcast today. And I look forward to continuing to listen
Thank
to
you.
Y'all and watching you grow and watching y'all grow this thing. Cause I love the name, first of all, the name's the purpose.
we're gonna keep trying to perfect this labor of love, and we'll just support each other. So I'm gonna let you go to Absolutely. Bed, and we're gonna go to bed. And we'll talk
okay.
soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Night.
You.